This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
Hello and welcome back to another week here at the Damage Report. I'm John Iadarola. It's gonna be a big one. Not the show. The show is we got nothing really. No, but the week is gonna be huge. I mean, are you ready for tomorrow, emotionally, intellectually, and indeed physically, for what could be an incredibly long night? We're gonna be doing live coverage from, I believe, 5 until God only knows, because of course, what's special about this Super Tuesday, what makes it even more super than usual, is that California is actually a part of it and California matters. And California is also on the West Coast and is very, very slow to count its votes. And so we're expecting it's gonna be a long day and a super consequential one too. If you care what happens in this Democratic primary, this might be the determining factor of whether we have a nominee going to the convention or not. Who that nominee is likely to be determined tomorrow. So we're gonna be giving you a little bit later on the show a few little news updates that might influence how Super Tuesday plays out. But that's the big show, and so we're definitely getting ready for it. And you can expect that later on today when Anna Kasparian returns and leads the main show, we're gonna be talking about quite a bit of what's gonna be affecting Super Tuesday there as well. But on this show, what you can expect is we've got 3 guests gonna be joining us. We've got a candidate. We've got Namiki Kantz back in the studio to talk about her new podcast. We've got an author. We don't often get to talk about to fiction authors, but very interesting book we're gonna profile. As well as we're gonna bid adieu to one of the presidential candidates that's been around since just about the very beginning. All that is later on. Let's start off with some important news updates. Coronavirus continues to develop and spread around the world, although there are some signs of hope, which we're going to get to. Now, you should know before we get to the hope that it has now spread to every continent except Antarctica. You know, we'll see if that ends up happening. It's infected nearly 90,000 people and killed more than 3,000. So that number does continue to go up. It is currently lower than some of the other pandemics that we've seen. You know, Ebola back in 2014 killed more people internationally, but this is spreading, so we will have to see. Now, in the United States, on Friday, there were 65 cases and no known deaths here in the US. Now, tragically, over the course of the weekend, a single hospital in Washington state reported 2 deaths, the makings of a cluster there, and the total number of cases nationwide jumped 35% to 88. Now, as you might have seen, both of the individuals who died at that Washington hospital did have underlying health issues that are believed to exacerbate coronavirus if it is found. We know that certain demographics are far more likely, tragically, to die if they contract the virus than younger, more healthier individuals. But we entered the weekend with no one having died, and we unfortunately did not leave the weekend in that same way. And so perhaps this is where it will end, but we do have to be ready for the possibility that that will not be the case. Now, let's zoom out. Worldwide situation of coronavirus. You can see a map here that's being constantly updated by the New York Times. And you can see there that we have the 88 cases now in the US. Significant percentage in Canada, 22, especially considering their far larger population there. But it is throughout the hemisphere, in Mexico and in Brazil, some other countries there in South America as well. And then on through Europe, Middle East, and Asia as well. Some very large clusters of cases too. For instance, Italy, which now has more than 1,600 confirmed cases. Iran, 1,500 with 66 deaths. Travelers from both countries appear to have spread the virus to other nations in the Middle East and Europe. Elsewhere, Indonesia, one of the few large nations thought to be free of the virus, said today that it had 2 confirmed cases, while others were reported from Australia to India to Portugal. And so there is bad news. The first deaths in the United States, explosions of cases in Italy and Iran, and some countries that had been free through several months of the spread of the disease internationally, now having their first cases. And some of the countries that already were pretty hard hit by the disease, the numbers are still fairly large, or very large, I should say. South Korea has 599 new cases, bringing its total to over 4,300 with 22 deaths. In China, the number of new cases was 202, bringing its total to over 80,000, including over 2,900 deaths. Now, that it's difficult to see how any of that can be considered good news, but you have probably heard the beginnings of the people almost don't want to say it out loud, but the possibility that in China that the rapid expansion of new cases has slowed. And so only a few hundred new cases being reported over the past couple of days is actually considered a great deal of progress there in China, where in some cases in a 24-hour period you had an explosion of many thousands of cases. That might be ending. But of course, until we're free of the disease entirely, we can't say for sure. We don't have necessarily the most sophisticated treatments possible like we do for some other diseases, and we certainly don't have a vaccine. And so we very much are not, you know, out of the danger zone there, but at least in China, by far the hardest hit country, there is some good news potentially. We will see in the United States, it's possible that those two deaths will be the last. But we do also know that some areas, even in the United States, are now seeing the spread. New York reported its first case in Manhattan over the weekend, and hopefully isolated. But the fear would be in a place as densely populated as Manhattan, as New York City, that they've gotten that person, but people might not yet have manifested symptoms. So we will have to see. Obviously, fingers crossed that that is not the case. Now, with that, why don't we turn from what I would say is a serious assessment of the actual state of the spread of the virus to right-wing propagandizing around it. Mike Pence is the man who has been put in charge nationally of protecting us from the spread of coronavirus, and he was recently interviewed by Jake Tapper. And one of the topics that was brought up was the partisanship around this topic, the attacks involving coronavirus. And he's gonna have to respond to one, I would say one of the most vicious attacks involving this disease from the president's son.
To try to take a pandemic and seemingly hope that it comes here and kills millions of people so that they could end Donald Trump's streak of winning is a new level of sickness.
Can we agree that neither Democrats nor Republicans want Americans to get the coronavirus and die from it? I mean, that does seem like it seems like very extreme rhetoric. I don't expect you to criticize the president's son, but you don't think that Democrats want people to contract this disease, do you?
Well, I think what the president said earlier this week, and his charge to me is to remind the American people that the risk is low, to assure the American people that we're ready. But also to say, as the president said, this is no time for politics. And frankly, I think that was Don Jr.'s point, that there has been some very strong rhetoric directed at the president by some members of Congress and
you don't think that was strong rhetoric?
Well,
he said seemingly Democrats want millions of Americans to die of coronavirus.
But responding to the kind of things that have been hurled is understandable, but.
Okay, and so I have multiple things I want to say. Overall, I would say there are a lot of words I would like to scream at Mike Pence right now that I am not allowed to, but rest assured I am thinking them. I will say screw Mike Pence. He's absolutely the worst. That was an embarrassing, pathetic performance that gives me even less faith that he's the sort of person who will seriously protect us from the possible spread of a deadly disease inside of our country. He was asked a very, 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 very simple question. Do the Democrats want millions of people to die? And he said, well, I think what Don Jr. was saying, no. What Don Jr. said was there are Democrats and people in the media that want millions to die. Do you agree with that or do you not? Does anyone, let's go wider, does anyone want millions of people to die? No, that is a ridiculous, horrific thing to say. And he wouldn't admit as much. And honestly, I'm glad that Jake Tapper asked the questions, but I'm frustrated with Jake Tapper too, because you did allow him to weasel his way out of criticizing the president's son. And by the way, Jake Tapper said, I don't expect you to criticize the president's son. Why? Why? He's not a 14-year-old. He's not a private citizen. He's the president's loser kid. That's all he is. We are not in some petty tin pot family dictatorship. We're in what is supposed to be a democratic republic, where simply being related to someone by blood doesn't give you any sort of protection from criticism, particularly when you say something as bloodthirsty and bombastic and insane as Democrats want millions of people to die. Don Jr. is not involved in politics. He's supposed to be off just doing the whole business thing. You remember that's why they didn't have to divest themselves, because Eric and Don were just gonna do the business stuff. But instead, he's calling into Fox News to attack the Democrats while supposedly decrying the spread of partisanship over the coronavirus. He said he is against that while claiming on state TV that the Democrats want millions of people to die. And Mike Pence can't even say, well, look, obviously nobody actually wants millions to die. The president's son is off base there. And look, honestly, if he had said that, what would have happened? He potentially would have been kicked out of his position by Donald Trump, who doesn't allow for any sort of criticism of his family like that. Now, here's the thing. Obviously, Mike Pence is insane. That was ridiculous. But you do have people politicizing this disease. It is simply the case that that's true. Mike Pence went on in that comment to say, well, you know, overall, the issue is that the left wing is using this. Did you see Trump's rally a few days ago where he attacked the Democrats specifically around the coronavirus over and over and over again? What about this? I'm going to show you a video clip. And the reason I'm showing it is you're probably not even going to see it very much. It was just a casual answer to a question. And even inside of that, he could not help but politicize coronavirus for his own political ends. Here's the president.
President, is it safe or appropriate to be holding rallies during a public health crisis like this?
Well, these were set up a long time ago, and others are. I mean, you could ask that to the Democrats, because they're having a lot of rallies. They're all having rallies. That's what they're doing. They're campaigning.
But do you think it's safe? Are you worried at all?
I think it's very safe, yeah. I think it's very safe.
He was asked a very simple question. Should you be having massive rallies when there's a fear of the coronavirus spreading? And he said, well, why don't you ask the Democrats that? They're having rallies. Mine was from a long time ago, but they're doing rallies. They're campaigning. Why don't you ask them? Well, first of all, they probably will ask them. They'll get to that. But he can't, there was nothing that was an attack against him. They didn't mention the Democrats. They didn't mention the election. They just mentioned the fact that he is doing these massive rallies. And he had to attack the Democrats over it. So spare me your tears over politicization of this issue. They're doing it on a daily basis. By the way, like, here's the thing. There's a very simple answer to the question that he was asked. You know what? I appreciate that question. Obviously, I, like all people, are concerned about the possible spread of this disease. And I'm going to say that while we do have to take all the proper and necessary precautions to make sure that people don't come down with coronavirus, at the same time, we do have to have a sober, reasonable view of what's happening. And while there have been cases in the United States, it is still extremely rare. And I, as president, don't want people to feel like they can't go about their lives. And so until we know otherwise, yes, we're gonna proceed with our rallies. We're gonna make sure that people are safe there. But as of right now, I feel like it is safe for you to go to malls, to go to ball games, to do all of those things. I don't want America to grind to a halt just because some people have unfortunately been struck with a terrible disease that we're doing everything we can to respond to. That's what an actual serious politician could say. That's what a serious adult could say. But instead, our petulant child of a president turned it into an attack against Democrats. Anyway, I did have a little bit more that I wanted to say about the Democratic primary, but we are racing through our time already. So we're gonna go to our first break. When we come back, a couple of guests are gonna be joining us after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called Un-F-ing the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of Un-F-ing the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today, and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
past few years, America has once again had to come to grips with public gatherings of white supremacists, neo-Nazis, the KKK, and others. And as that has become a bigger part of this social political thing we have in America, Art has had to grapple with that as well. And so I'm very excited to welcome to the show former federal civil rights prosecutor and the author of No Truth Left to Tell, Michael Bacaloff. Welcome to the Damage Report.
Hi, John.
Very glad to have you here. So we don't often have authors of fictional works on the show, but there's fairly obvious thematic and specific topical ties in your book to what we're experiencing. So, but first off, can you give just a brief idea of what the book is all about?
Well, the book is about in a modern setting, chasing a resurgent Klan that's trying to start a new race war. And a federal civil rights prosecutor from DC joins an FBI agent. And they try to solve a series of hate crimes, and they have to battle each other, their own stereotypes of the South, in order to stop the violence from escalating.
Okay, and importantly, this is about the KKK back in just the 1990s. This is not, you know, going all the way back to the 30s, 40s, 50s, or 60s. What made you want to set it in that particular time period?
Well, I actually was a young federal civil rights prosecutor in the early 90s and did have occasion to chase the Klan in the South during that time. I thought it was recent enough that it's in our current memory, but not today, not contemporaneous. I wanted it to be a little bit of distance from our contemporary discussions, but still relevant in terms of time frame.
You know, and we happen to notice that in the book summary, it's described as a timely legal thriller. Now, obviously, it's set back in the 90s, but as you allude to there, this is something that we're talking about. So tell me a little bit about that. I mean, obviously, it is a work of fiction. It is an artistic work. But to what extent were you sort of attempting to provide commentary on what we're currently grappling with?
I think I wanted it to be an entertaining story, a fictional story, but be relevant and resonate to today's issues. I hope we'll find out whether we've been successful in that attempt. Race and power, police misconduct, our notions of criminal justice, truth, how we exact confessions from subjects, folks that we all agree, people who committed crimes, but there are rules regarding how you hold them accountable. And so all those are the underlying themes of the novel. And I think they're as relevant today as they were 10 years ago, 50 years ago.
And you know, I can imagine people coming from a variety of different walks of life tackling this sort of material. You come at it from, as you alluded to, you had a version of this life yourself back in the 90s. You are a former federal civil rights prosecutor. So what do you think that brings to the book?
I hope some authenticity. I hope some insight in terms of the people that you meet, the issues that you grapple with when you go. In the criminal section of the Civil Rights Division, it's a specialized unit at the Justice Department where you go and throughout the United States to investigate and prosecute, among other cases, police misconduct cases and cases of racial violence. So I think those experiences translated into a fictional setting and narrative, I hope one retains that sense of authenticity and realism, even in a fictional story.
And so there's a couple of things I'd like to find out about. I know it might be a little bit preemptive, the book comes out tomorrow, but I'm curious, you're writing a book about the resurgence of the KKK, which is an actual serious concern. When you're out there promoting it, when you're interviewing, when you're hearing from prospective readers, what do people think of the KKK these days? Do they get that this is still very much a real concern, or does it seem to some people like an archaic throwback?
You know, I think the folks who are likely to be readers of the book are pre-sensitized to the fact that racial violence is still very much a part of our American culture, unfortunately, and that we need to be vigilant in how we deal with extremists. Now, part of the underlying theme of the book is that the sinners have the same rights as the saints among us, and that the process that we use to hold the extremist accountable makes a difference, because that's what helps us be different. That's helps us define what we are as America.
And you know, I guess similar sort of area. I've noticed over the past few years, artistic works that dabble in this area, that provide commentary on the sort of rise of very public white supremacy. I can think of like the Wolfenstein series of video games received a lot of pushback for their negative portrayal of Nazis. There was one of the Far Cry games had a sort of religious white supremacist cult. There was a lot of controversy around that. The movie The Hunt actually got pulled because it was considered to have this political viewpoint. Did you have, as you were working on this, did you have any sort of fears that there might be a sensitivity on the part of the publisher, possibly, that you might offend people by portraying the KKK and all of that?
I really didn't. We'll see. You'll see if there's any pushback from an unexpected quarter. I don't portray the Klan in any way as positively. I do portray the Constitution and the protections and the criminal justice system that doesn't distinguish between favorable and unfavorable, sympathetic and unsympathetic. That's not to say, and the book is all about how you do actually hold extremists accountable when they cross the line and hurt other people. But we have these set of rules, both in the Constitution and in our criminal justice system, that we do it fairly and that we respect the rights of everyone, even when it's really difficult to do that, and even when it comes at a cost.
Yeah, and for all the reasons that you've alluded to, it's obviously a very timely topic that our country's dealing with right now. Michael Pakaloff, thank you for joining us. The book is No Truth Left to Tell, and it's available tomorrow. We really appreciate you joining us on the show today.
Thank you, John.
Thank you. We're gonna take a short break, but we've got a guest in studio after this.
After a year of going everywhere, meeting everyone, defying every expectation, seeking every vote, the truth is that the path has narrowed to a close for our candidacy, if not for our cause.
So that was Pete Buttigieg announcing that he's leaving the race, and I'm gonna keep it real. I know I'm biased and everything. After more than a year, I could not tell you what the cause is, at least in any kind of concise sense. And I think in the end, that did really hurt him. So Pete Buttigieg came into this race unknown nationally. That's obviously a difficult obstacle to overcome. And he attempted to pitch himself first as an alternative to the progressives in the race. You know, saying things like he supposedly supported Medicare for all. And also in terms of structural changes of the country, he wanted to, you know, give statehood to Puerto Rico and Washington, automatic voter registration nationally, get rid of the Electoral College, like these sort of big ideas, changes to the Supreme Court. And that didn't actually bear out. After 2, 3, 4 months, he started to change over to, you know what, I'm an alternative to Biden, or potentially to Klobuchar or Warren, and his positions on the big issues shifted accordingly. And so I think that made it a very difficult sell. And at the same time, his fundraising strategy, which has been rightly criticized as being focused on, yes, some broad-based support, but also very large donations from extremely wealthy people, was always going to provide a sort of baseline suspicion. And for someone who we don't know a lot about, who doesn't have a record, doesn't have even a record of, you know, holding the same position for 10 years or something like that, that suspicion can be fatal. And I think that in this particular case, it was, especially combined with a very crowded field of people making something like the pitch that he was. But because he's been in this thing for so long, I do want to give him a chance to say it in his own words. So here is a bit more from yesterday's announcement.
And another of those values is responsibility. And we have a responsibility to consider the effect of remaining in this race any further. Our goal has always been to help unify Americans to defeat Donald Trump and to win the era for our values. And so we must recognize that at this point in the race, the best way to keep faith with those goals and ideals is to step aside and help bring our party and our country together. So tonight, I am making the difficult decision to suspend my campaign for the presidency.
And so with that, he is out. And look, I will give credit to any candidate who looks, you know, at the states that'll come, the elections that'll come, the polls that we can see, and knows that there's no chance. Not necessarily in all of their cases 100% credit, because they might not be dropping out because they don't think they have a chance, but because it is designed to benefit someone else. And I'll get to that in just a second. But like when Tom Steyer dropped out, you know, about a day earlier, he wasn't going to become president. He certainly wasn't going to get the most delegates. He wasn't going to win a single state. And if you like Pete Buttigieg, if you see that, it is, I think, insulting in general, but also especially to your supporters to continue to run, to ask them to spend time, energy, and in many cases, money as well, asking for them to donate to a cause that you know can't succeed. Now, a lot of politicians still do that. They stay in far longer than they should. And why not? They're being paid to fly around the country giving speeches, raising their profile, and making it likely that they'll be able to get speaking engagements, possibly a position on a, you know, a cable news channel, sell a book, that sort of thing. But that's not an integrity move. And so, you know, credit to anyone who drops out. Now, why is he dropping out? Is it just because he doesn't see a path forward? Not necessarily so. Klobuchar faces the exact same path that he does, and she's staying in. Elizabeth Warren, a very similar one. She's likely to get more delegates than either of those other two, but she's definitely not going to get the plurality, let alone a majority. But let's see if we can figure it out, because he did have a little bit more to say in his remarks, and he's not naming any particular candidates here, but I think we can understand the subtext.
Today, I am more and more convinced that the only way we will defeat Trump and Trumpism is with a new politics that gathers people together. We need leadership to heal a divided nation, not drive us further apart. We need a broad-based agenda that can truly deliver for the American people, not one that gets lost in ideology.
Okay, so I feel fairly confident in saying that that was about Bernie Sanders, I think. I don't think I'm being crazy and biased when I say that. And let me just reiterate, like, again, he's out. Maybe it's unnecessary to punch someone in the back as they walk out of the room. But I don't know what this new politics thing means. I don't know what healing the nation means when he says it. When I could say it and mean something, I would probably want to give you a little bit more details. But when he uses those phrases, it's like, dude, I get it. I loved Barack Obama's speeches too, but that's not the whole thing. Oh, we're getting breaking news? Okay, we'll turn to that in just a second. Thank you, Skip. That's the magic of live TV. Pete Buttigieg will not be alone for long, because while I do have a little bit more on him, apparently Klobuchar has dropped out as well. Live update here on the Damage Report. And look, as much as I love, you know, attacking Buttigieg, throwing him under the bus, if you watch this show for a long time, you know that I love throwing myself under the bus even more. I didn't predict that either of them will drop out. It really did seem like they were going to stick around as long as possible to make the case for themselves at a contested convention that they should be the one. They're not doing that, so uncredit to me for a bad prediction. But we can also learn quite a bit from the timing of these dropouts. Tom Steyer, I think, is a separate case, but Buttigieg and now Klobuchar, if they are dropping out, it is a combination of knowing that they're not going to be president, not wanting to look absolutely horrible on Super Tuesday, especially if they're planning to run again in the future, and protecting Joe Biden and giving him a better chance of winning. Now, he needs all the delegates he can if he's going to go against Bernie Sanders, make a real show of it. This will help a little bit. Although, honestly, looking ahead to the Super Tuesday states, I don't know what states. Maybe Klobuchar and Buttigieg together might have been polling at 6 or 8 or 10%. That is entirely possible. But let's also bear in mind that the math on where these candidates' supporters go is not necessarily always as clean as you or I might believe. When you look at Pete Buttigieg, for instance, his supporters, who's their second choice? Do you know who it is? Bernie Sanders has the plurality. It's still not a lot. It's like 21%, and it drops down to other candidates from there. You know, a good amount go to Biden, a good amount go to Bloomberg. But we can't say for sure how this is actually going to affect Super Tuesday. And also bear in mind that in many of these states, people have been voting for quite a while in early voting. In California, millions of people have already cast their vote. And so these sort of dropouts, even if they're designed to help a particular candidate, and I think the proof of the pudding will really be in whether they give a public endorsement later on today. It isn't necessarily able to accomplish all it's intended because so many people have already voted. Now, I will say, to the effect of the point I just said a second ago, CBS News, Ed O'Keefe said, Pete Buttigieg and Joe Biden have spoken by telephone in the wake of the former mayor's decision to end his presidential bid. Two people familiar with the call tell him and another reporter. No word yet on whether an endorsement is forthcoming, although it is not difficult to imagine that that might in fact come. I mean, how important will that be remains to be seen. But I will say that I think for Pete Buttigieg, it's a pretty easy choice to make for what he imagines his future to be. Because during his remarks, some people began chanting 2024. And if you think there is a chance in hell he's not already planning his next presidential run, you're crazy. You are simply crazy. So whatever he does, sure, it might be designed to help one candidate or another now. But a lot like Ted Cruz, it is about the long game, at least for him. I can't say for Klobuchar if she wants to engage in this again. But Pete Buttigieg, he is a condensed ball of ambition and entitlement. And so he will definitely be running again. Now, one last thing. I understand that I've been incredibly critical of him. Now, that is not meant to take away from the accomplishment of what he was able to achieve. I don't begrudge him that. Coming into this thing as a small town mayor, particularly like the best performing openly LGBT candidate in American history, that is an impressive accomplishment. And for anyone across this country that was inspired by that, either to engage in politics broadly or to run themselves, that is an incredible achievement. I hope that it did have that effect. But at the same time, all of the stuff we've been criticizing for a long time, undercut or underlined in major cases by the fact that the media, they gave him a pass for that first year. There was almost no critical reporting of his work in the private sector, let alone his time as mayor of South Bend. And that was incredibly frustrating, particularly at a time when he was rising in the polls and people were only interested in what instruments he played and what languages he spoke, not what he'd actually done in his life. So again, credit where credit is due, and the opposite as well. Okay, with that, we are gonna take a short break. Lots more to come. Joining us now is a candidate for Senate in the state of Colorado, Diana Bray. Welcome to the Damage Report.
Thank you so much.
Glad to have you here. So, I'm very interested to have you introduce yourself to your audience so we can talk about your platform. What's your background? What are you bringing to this race?
So I'm a clinical psychologist and I'm a mom of four, and I've actually been working in climate activism for 10 years. And I decided to get into this race because I didn't see others who had been working in climate or understood the gravity of the climate emergency. And my husband and I were in Australia with our four kids, and we saw that there was a move to basically dredge a harbor in order to build three liquefied natural gas plants, which they did on the Great Barrier Reef. And they actually dumped the spoil there, came back to Colorado and realized that we had become a petro state with 65,000 oil and gas wells, and we now have a F rating with the American Lung Association.
Wow.
We're sort of punching above our weight with damage.
Well, you know, I'm perfectly happy to start at the climate crisis and dealing with that. So in terms of your activism, tell me a little bit, how have things changed over the past 10 years? I mean, back 10 years ago, there weren't as many people or organizations talking about it. Now it is a high profile issue. So tell me a little bit about that evolution.
Well, honestly, we used to go and protest and we'd act like an oil spill or something, and there'd be 10 of us essentially protesting and trying to bring attention to what was going on. And literally, there would be 10 of us, say, protesting in front of the former governor's mansion, John Hickenlooper, and half of them would be my own kids. The change that I see is now that there's a huge amount of progressive energy and people are understanding the enormity of the crisis, the existential crisis of our time. And that is the major difference. How do you wrap your mind around 85,000 koalas being burnt to death? How do you wrap your mind around people having to walk into billabongs and lakes and rivers and the ocean to escape fire? The droughts, the hurricanes, all of these are increasing, and people are finally aware that we have to do something. And it's the existential crisis of our time, but also there's going to be 200 million to a billion climate refugees. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be a destabilizing force everywhere. So people have finally become interested. Where we used to be in the minority, now people are interested.
So tell me about your plan. If you make it into office, what would you like to do to help address this climate crisis?
Well, first, we absolutely have to stop subsidizing the oil and gas industry. That's the first thing. Secondly, we have to stop exporting fossil fuels, and we also have to stop drilling on public lands. There are so many measures that the federal government could take that they're not taking. And it was incredibly disappointing to me in 2018 when our four Democratic gubernatorial candidates did not support a move to keep fracking out of our backyards. When you have candidates and electeds, Democrats, who are not interested in supporting these measures to regulate fracking and industrial activity, it's a real problem. And so we have to get more candidates in, more representatives who are not beholden to the oil and gas industry, who are not interested in trying to support or bolster that, and are not interested in bolstering this corporate stranglehold that is now present. And it's not just oil and gas. If you are somebody who supports the NRA or Big Pharma, you are supporting the GOP and their methods for sort of trying to make money and essentially have this greedy kind of business model that is not working for many of our people on the planet. And it is sort of this irony that the most vulnerable people are going to be more impacted, and the rich are literally going to be scrambling on top of each other and trying to get literally to high ground to try to escape climate disaster. Well, what we see with the coronavirus and with other infectious diseases, those are going to be increasing. And so I am also proposing and promoting a Medicare for All, because that is a system that I think will work for everyone in a way that our current system does not.
And so I'm curious, two of the potential opponents, one current, one possibly future. Inside of the primary, you have John Hickenlooper, and you are running to potentially go up against Cory Gardner, the GOP incumbent. On these big issues, which you're focusing on your platform, dealing with the climate crisis, Medicare for All, what's the distinction between you and those two opponents of yours?
Well, we couldn't be more different, honestly. John Hickenlooper did more than anyone, I think, else in this entire state for 8 years to try to promote oil and gas. And he actually sued counties and cities that tried to ban fracking. And what I think is extreme is the fact that many people are willing to tolerate people and families, kids getting sick, people who are having bloody noses and respiratory illnesses. That's what's extreme. But unfortunately, our current administration, and as well as people who are here in my race, Hickenlooper in particular, have done all they can to support the oil and gas industry. And we now have a situation where we are having tremendous health impacts. I mean, these chemicals are carcinogens, they're endocrine disruptors, they're neurotoxins, and these are doing great harm to us. So there's the local impacts, and I think it's unforgivable what John Hickenlooper fostered in this state, because he hasn't been, and I think he's out of touch, frankly, with people. I think that that we're going to find out tomorrow. I believe that Bernie is going to win this state, and that he's going to do very well tomorrow all over the country in the in Super Tuesday. But I don't believe that John Hickenlooper has vision for the future. And there are 10 of us in this race. There are some very progressive women, but we are bringing a completely different idea to this race in terms of where we're going. We have progressive energy, and I'm the only person who's actually worked in climate, and it has been incredibly devastating to me personally. It's been my obsession to be focusing on this for 10 years, and there just hasn't been that much interest amongst centrist Democrats or Republicans, of course. So I'm trying to bring change, and I think that we're going to have an opportunity this time around, because there is so much progressive vision. And I think most people are now saying, no, we don't want that archaic way of digging fossil fuels out of the land and burning them. That's past. That time is past. Mm-hmm. And we need to move on to renewable energy and a just transition.
Okay, Diana Bray, thank you once again for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
We're going to take one last break here at the Damage Report and then close out with a little bit more for you. And now to close out the show, I hear that we've got someone special on the line. Nomi returns to the Dan Report. How's it going?
How are you, John?
I'm glad to have you here, and especially to talk about your new venture. I hear you've got a show.
I do. I even have a mug now. I'm so official.
Well, I don't have a mug. I've been doing this for years. That's wow, you are on the ball.
You know, we need to get the word out. We launched a show a little over a month ago, and as it's the season, so people want to learn about what's happening with the Democratic Party primaries. So we're growing pretty steadily on YouTube and Patreon at the Nomi Key Show. Mm-hmm. We're very excited because the goal of the show is to really pull back the curtain of the process. You know, what's happening in the Democratic Party primary, how the DNC works, how all of these like grifty organizations that support the status quo work. And of course, you know, what's the deal with superdelegates? Because, you know, I had to go through the torture of, mm-hmm. of being part of this process. I might as well be a service to the universe, the progressive exactly. universe.
Yeah, and also as a voice who can accurately describe what that process was like and not look back on it and pitch it as something that it was not, which we've seen a lot of over the past few days. So for people who haven't yet watched the show, what's the format? Where can they find it? How often does it come out?
So we do a full-length show once a week. And it's a more evergreen show. So I like to uncover some part of the democratic process in my opening. And then I'll usually have one or two guests on. One is a deeper dive on a specific topic. And then maybe the other is a follow the money type of segment. That show comes out on Patreon first every single weekend on Saturday. So if you're a patron, you want to be a patron, go to patreon.com/thenomikeyshow. And then we post it on YouTube. And then during the week, I will just do pickup interviews because as much as I wanted this to be a once a week show, I can't fight it. So I do these pickup interviews and I'll do live commentary. Like I'm going to do live commentary today at 5:30 PM Eastern on the breaking news of Amy Klobuchar getting out of the race, as well as Pete and what that means. And yeah, I mean, it's pretty simple. You can go to YouTube, look for the Nomi Key Konst. That show is going to be on there. And then Patreon is where you help us survive.
The news is breaking fast.
Live event today. I'm so sorry. If I could just do one little plug. If you're in the Los Angeles area, we are doing a live show with some of the greats of TYT and others, Michael Brooks, Francesca Fiorentini, Lucy Flores, Justin Jackson from the LA Chargers, Nando Vila, myself, David Dayan. We're going to be on stage talking about what's happening as it comes in on Tuesday in LA. And you can go to my Twitter to find that.
Awesome. Well, and let's look forward to the future of the show. Who are some of the people that you're planning to bring on? Who are some of your dream gets for your podcast? Who would you like to break down the news with?
So I actually reached out to Noam Chomsky in the fall when I was in Tucson visiting my family for the holidays. And I'm going to be going out in person to Tucson, Arizona, where he teaches. I went to University of Arizona. He teaches there. It's kind of exciting. So I'll be doing a sit down with him. That, I think, is my dream. Like, you know, the dinner that I want, it would be with like Noam Chomsky. And it's happening. So that's exciting. And I think coming up, you're going to see more conversations with people that you may not necessarily know, but have a lot of power over the Democratic Party process. I'll be going into, calling up superdelegates and having them come on the show. Maybe a little bit more behind the scenes stuff, but I think it's important and it's what people crave. You know, in terms of dream guests, I mean, I'm a woman of the. I like the journalists that don't get the coverage on cable news. I like the activists who don't get the attention but have profound stories. I like the candidates. You know, you do this so well. You highlight candidates who are working very hard. And in a presidential cycle, they may not be getting the amount of attention that they deserve. So I like to highlight them. And, and I like to bring fresh faces on that are doing great work, like Sam Finkelstein, who's our contributor for Follow the Money.
Exactly. Well, obviously a lot to look forward to. I hope that people check it out. And, maybe we can touch base in a couple of weeks and talk a little bit more about the show. But for now, Nomi, thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, John. I appreciate it.
Thank you. And best of luck. For everybody at home, thank you for joining us here. I did want to just read one little, because we also do a podcast. So a review of it from Andy Gates, who said, the more I get educated about the maddening state of our political media machine, I feel validated on my viewpoints. But much more importantly, I'm learning to articulate them better to other people. Thank you, TYT, for being a strong beacon in the fog of all this chaos. Andy Gates, thank you for leaving that review that is on Apple Podcasts. You could leave both a written review and also a star rating to help get the message out about our little podcast. You can also check out Nomi's as well at the same time. So thank you for joining us for this episode. A little bit later on today, Anna Kasparian will be back in studio. I'll be doing the main show with her. And so you can expect 2 hours of that. And also gird yourself for tomorrow, because Super Tuesday is going to be absolutely massive. And you know, could determine how this entire thing plays out. So I'll see you just a little bit later on today. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.